From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking. Good morning, I'm Chris Nolte. Dignitaries and other people have come into Northwest Indiana in recent days as they are participating in the very first COVID-19 vaccination site. It's being held in Gary. Carrie Napoleon with the Post Tribune has been covering that and other stories, and we have her today to talk about it. Carrie, thanks for joining us on the program, first off.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, first off, fill us in here about what the dignitaries had to say when they showed up at Gary Roosevelt High School for that mass vax session.
Well, that site is, it's really something. It's a collaboration, federal, state, local. There's partnerships all around that are making this happen, and it is tremendous, the number of people. I was out there yesterday for their first full day of vaccinations. I was out in the morning. It's really amazing the number of cars they can get through there, how well run it is. It's just really a nice operation. The governor was up here, Congressman Mervan, Deputy Mayor Trent McCain, Eddie Melton, Senator Eddie Melton, State Rep Earl Harris. There were a number of people up here, and Dr. Christina Box was up here both Tuesday and then Wednesday morning to launch the first full day of people driving through.
Now, I understand that unlike the previous vaccination sessions held in other places, you have an option in this one. If you show up, you drive up or you walk up, you can get your vaccination shot now. And not have to necessarily have to wait for your appointment. Will you fill us in on how they've set that up on this particular case in Gary?
They said that they are working, you know, if you come in, they prefer that people obviously make an appointment if they can. But if they have the doses and you come through, they are going to give you a shot. Dr. Bach said if they start running low on shots, she could seek more of Indiana's allocation to be directed up here. So they're confident for this eight-week clinic, they're going to have enough shots for whoever wants to get vaccinated.
And I also understand, too, that that they're expanding even beyond Northwest Indiana, although, of course, they're targeting Northwest Indiana communities like Gary and East Chicago and Hammond and Whiting and the like. But they'll take anybody, apparently, even from across the state line.
Correct. This is a federally funded site. There is no local money going into this. So anybody, I mean, you could come from California, I suppose, and get your vaccination here. But there were quite a few folks from Illinois there. Anecdotally, from my observation, about one in four cars had an Illinois license plate that was going through the line. Now, this clinic is also offering mobile clinics. They're going to be going each day into different communities in Northwest Indiana, bringing doses to people that may not have the ability to travel out of their neighborhood. So that is another way that they're vaccinating people through this clinic. So they're hoping to do about 3,000 people a day.
Wow. Now, do you think that in line with the fact that the governor has already said that that younger people, that is, you know, short of being young teens, can go ahead and get the vaccine, and there'll be more people, of course, they'll be eligible for the vaccination, that's going to make a difference in getting more people to show up at the vaccination sites?
Oh, for sure. And there were quite a few teens I noticed there the first day yesterday. Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised, but there were quite a few in line with their parents. I talked to a family who was bringing their 16-year-olds to come through there because they want to travel and go visit family in Mexico. So they want the girls to get their vaccine.
That's great.
So there were quite a few teens there, a lot of people there.
One of the other stories you have out there in print and online in the Post Tribune is a story with some good news for residents of Gary who are concerned about whether there'll be enough fire trucks to make it in case their house catches on fire, their business catches on fire, and they got a big donation. Tell us about that story, please.
Well, in Gary, they have enough fire trucks. The two of their fire trucks are out of commission right now because they got an accident. Mm-hmm. They were struck by other vehicles. One was struck during the snowstorm when they were responding on 8094, and another was struck last year. And now these are big vehicles. It takes a while to get them repaired. It takes a while. They have to go back to the factory, so it takes them a while to get a slot in line to get the repair done. So it takes a while to get these repairs. In the meantime, they've been using their backup units. So they've had plenty to respond, but the backup units are old. And what Valparaiso did was offer up their backup unit, which is actually a little older, but since they don't have the type of demand in Valparaiso that they have in Gary, it has much less miles and much less uses on it. It's a really nice truck. It's a 1996. and they were able to transfer it over. Valparaiso is a fire territory, so they're their own taxing district, so they have more funds for capital purchases. And, you know, they when they replace their equipment, they either put it in their reserve or try and find somebody else to use it. They've donated to Portage before, I believe out of the country to, like, Guatemala. So this is the first time with Gary, and hopefully this is going to happen later this year when they get a couple more new trucks in Valparaiso.
That's great. What kind of reaction have you heard of in this inter-city cooperation between, in this case, between Gary and Valparaiso?
You know, these guys, the fire community, they all stick together and work together. They're friends, and that's how this kind of came about. I mean, a couple of one of the fellows from Gary and one of the fellows from Valparaiso were friends. They started talking about what was going on, and, you know, the conversation was like, well, hey, we've got this. Let's help you with it. We can help mm-hmm. you now. So, you know, because of those relationships, it, you know, really works out nice. And the city is grateful, you know, anytime you can get equipment like that, knew that something like this would cost, you know, $500,000, if not more. The value at this point is, you know, for resale, probably only about $15,000, they said. But still, it's a workable, nice piece of equipment that you don't have to purchase.
Well, Kerry, one of the other stories that you had out in print and online in the Post-Tribune also covers some news out of federal court about a case that involves an East Chicago police officer. Will you fill us in about what that lawsuit's all about and how it ended up?
Yes. Well, right now, the lawsuit is still pending. Mm-hmm. There's been no talks or settlements or anything of that nature. So at this point, it's going towards trial. But it was before the court for a summary dismissal, and that was rejected. And what the suit is about is two female East Chicago police officers were in the field officer training program. And Sergeant Judith Parks was part of that program as one of their instructors. And they alleged that Sergeant Parks sexually harassed them and created a hostile work environment. And one of the allegations is that he requested nude photos of both of these women during this time period. Mm-hmm. And what is interesting about that is that's not disputed. In his own deposition, Parks did not dispute that he requested those photos. His deposition essentially said, I didn't think it was offensive in the time of cell phones.
So the judge dismissed the summary judgment case, and you say that the case, that means that the lawsuit is still going on. It has yet to be completely resolved.
Exactly. Based on the evidence, the judge said no reasonable jury can conclude necessarily that this didn't happen. So it has to at least go to the jury to mm-hmm. be decided. They feel that there is definitely enough evidence and the facts are not in dispute. And basically, the facts aren't in dispute because in their own depositions, they admitted a lot of this.
Well, sounds like it's a matter that will still come up in court and we'll still be finding out, and you'll be bringing us up to date in stories in the future, I'm sure, on this, Kerry. We thank you very much for bringing us up to date on this story that showed up in print and online, and hope to have you back on Regionally Speaking again soon.
Thank you.
Kerry Napoleon is a reporter for the Post-Tribune, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. Indiana Dunes National Park is looking for volunteers for its first ever Indiana Dunes Trash Truckers Earth Day Cleanup. Registration is now open for this year's event, which is going to be held on Thursday, April 22nd from 9 a.m. until noon. Supervisory Park Ranger and the Public Information Officer at the Dunes National Park, Bruce Rowe, told Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about the event and how to get involved.
This is the first time we've had an Earth Day cleanup, where we've invited the general public to work together with our staff and our regular volunteers to do a cleanup throughout the entire Indiana Dunes National Park.
And so what's needed of the volunteers, and what is the criteria, the requirements to be a volunteer?
Well, any adult or any group of adults is welcome to volunteer. Children would have to be with an adult or guardian to volunteer. But anybody who wants to get outside on April 22nd from 9 a.m. to about noon and clean up the park, the trails, the roads, even the Little Calumet River we're going to do some cleaning of, is welcome to join.
Okay, and then how do people get involved in it? How do people join up?
Okay, they need to call our park volunteer office or email them. The phone number is area code 219-221-7098, or you can email them at parkconnection@gmail.com.
Has pollution been a problem? Is there a lot to clean up?
Well, we're not looking specifically at pollution. We're looking more at litter. Every winter, you know, a little bit of litter builds up day by day, it seems. And by springtime, after the snow's all melted and things start greening up, the evidence of that trash that's collected over the winter is very evident. So we try and do some cleaning in the spring each year, but this is the first time we're really opening it up to the public as well as our staff.
And what's the benefits to people to join?
Well, I think it's a way to make your park area and Northwest Indiana in general a little bit cleaner, take some pride in having a national park here and helping to make it as clean as we can.
That's Sharon Jackson speaking with Indiana Dunes National Park Ranger and spokesperson Bruce Rowe about the Volunteer Cleanup Day coming up on April 22nd. From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking and Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Let's check in with Mary Freda, who is a reporter with the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the story she's put out online and in print. And Mary, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, you had some interesting stories here, one involving a Cedar Lake fire chief and a couple involving some of the latest issues involving schools in Northwest Indiana and the pandemic. Let's take up the story about the Cedar Lake fire chief first. And I guess it's an update from an earlier story, is it not? Well, bring us up to date about the story, please.
Of course. We learned a couple of weeks ago about allegations that were detailed in a police report from earlier this year that included Cedar Lake Fire Chief Todd Wilkening. Now, we were not able to reach Mr. Wilkening for our first story, but he was present at a town council meeting this week where he issued a statement because he was suspended due to the allegations mentioned in this police report. I will say the police report came after a volunteer firefighter was arrested for running a red light and driving while under the influence. And according to the police report, Wilkening arrived at the Lowell Police Department with another man and requested information as to why a Lowell Police Department officer was working a grant in Cedar Lake and arresting, quote, my guys. The report also stated Wilkening said he would have liked for the volunteer firefighter to have been given a professional courtesy. Now, Wilkening has not directly addressed any of these allegations that were outlined in the report, but did issue a statement this week and said he would have given a statement to the media in hindsight about his suspension, which was for not disciplining the volunteer firefighter and not making the safety board aware of the volunteer firefighter's behavior. Mm-hmm. The Times has yet to speak directly with Wilkening about the allegations detailed in the report.
It sounds like it's just maybe not enough information was given out at the right time, perhaps?
It's tough to say. The town council president said, you know, it was hard to determine. It's not that they didn't believe the police officer who wrote the report, but they also had no reason not to believe Chief Wilkening, who gave the board his own account of what happened that night. So it sounds like we're still waiting to hear from all parties involved.
Well, sounds like we'll have probably another story coming out on this some other time, just with the updates at least as to what happened involving not only the original case of the volunteer firefighter who got stopped by the police, and also how Fire Chief Wilkening seemed to have reacted to all of this, too. So we'll watch for that in the future. The other stories that you had out in print and online, deals with the resignation of a South Lake County school superintendent. Fill us in about Ron Garten, please.
Earlier this year, a anonymous letter sent to the Tri-Creek School Board, as well as the Indiana State Police, expressed concern over relationships Garten had developed with students in his district. Now, Garten has an investigation into these alleged behaviors, which were called grooming behaviors in this letter, were unfounded by the school district's investigation into this letter. The letter was given or sent to the school board, rather, in late January, and Garden's position has kind of remained in the balance since. He did request a temporary leave of absence in wake of the allegations in this letter and had not returned as superintendent following the letter. An interim was named in his absence, and following that, he did resign from his position. The allegations in this letter, which was sent by an anonymous person who the school board tried to get to come to investigations, they've said, details Garden's behavior, which included trading texts, offering rides, giving longer than comfortable back and shoulder rubs, and said he would often interrupt instruction to take students on walks, buy them breakfast, or offer them food and candy. Now, the school board and Garden in a letter maintained that the behaviors in that anonymous letter were falsehoods.
Mm-hmm. I understand that the school board certainly was not unhappy with how Garden had served as superintendent until this latest set of incidents apparently came up.
Yes. In a letter issued, school board president Doug Ward thanked Garden for his work at the district and praised everything that he did, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. He lauded Garden's service and many accomplishments during his almost 3-year tenure. He took the helm of the corporation in July 1st, 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the school board was happy with his performance, Ward said.
And they do have somebody that's certainly filling in as at least interim superintendent, I understand, but they're looking for a new one now, I understand, also.
Yes. In wake of the allegations against Garden, the school board named Deborah Howe as interim superintendent. Now, that name might sound familiar to Tri Creek families because before Garden took over, Howe was the superintendent in the district. Now, her interim position is limited until the end of the school year, according to a contract that was approved by the school board earlier this year, but the contract can be extended while the school board searches, or rather the district searches, for a new permanent superintendent.
We're talking with Mary Frieda, who is with the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the story she's put out in print and online, and another story involving school districts. And the pandemic brings us up to date on what's happening in the city of Hammond. If you will, tell us about that story.
Yeah, so this week, Hammond students returned to in-person learning for the first time since last year. The school city of Hammond is one of the last districts to return to in-person learning in Northwest Indiana. And, the district said that it felt like the first day of school, except there was a little bit of a difference with the COVID safety precautions in place. So instead of perhaps students rushing into school, they had to wait in a socially distanced line before greeting their teachers and friends who, of course, were masked up.
I understand, though, that the students can keep on their remote learning if necessary, if their parents are concerned about them being in the classrooms, so that there's not a lot of change, but there is at least, looks like, some flexibility that the school city of Hammond's allowing for students and the families.
Certainly. It should be noted that only 26% of the school city's population returned to in-person learning mm-hmm. on Tuesday, but Superintendent Scott Miller said the district isn't forcing students to come back, and in fact said at previous board meetings that any families who said previously they wanted to come back but then changed their mind wouldn't be stuck with that choice. Now, Scott Miller has said that if parents now wish for their students to go back to school, that each school building has a process in place and they're going to be looking out for when it might be safe to allow more students to return to the school buildings.
It looks like it's a work in progress, just as everything seems to be during the pandemic. And I guess we'll have updates, no doubt, from the school city of Hammond about this in the future, too. Mary Frieda is a reporter for The Times, and she's bringing us up to date on her stories. And Mary, thank you for spending time with us today to go over them for us.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Indiana legislators are currently crafting a 2-year budget for the state. How will the funds be allocated? Indiana lawmakers host John Schwantes asks a bipartisan legislative panel, including Representative Tim Brown, the ranking minority leader, Democratic State Representative Greg Porter of Indianapolis, Republican State Senator Eric Bassler, a ranking member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and Democratic State Senator Eddie Melton of Gary, about how Hoosiers may be impacted. Here's the conversation.
Let me start, Tim Brown, with you, because you're a physician. So let me start by asking you for some free medical advice. What are we going to do with this extra COVID relief money? Indiana's share is estimated to be $5.8 billion, of which $3 billion or so would go to the state. Another $200 million would go to state's capital projects plan and so forth, the rest going, of course, to local and county governments. What do you do with that? That's a lot of money.
Well, I think it's opportunity for the state of Indiana. I mean, one of the things about Indiana is we're number one in the Midwest, and so we've been very resilient through this recession and pandemic and able to bounce back very, very well. And so we look at this federal money as one-time spending. Is there infrastructure we need to spend it on, which are highways, or is it water and sewer infrastructure that we need to spend it on so that we can help every community and citizen throughout the whole state?
Of course, a lot of the things you just mentioned there about infrastructure, they're going to be taken care of with the next stimulus package. The other two, I was joking before, you guys aren't going to have a budget for the next decade at the rate we're going. Who should make the decision, by the way, about how?
It will be a joint decision, because some of the money won't come in until after we're gone from session at the end of April. And then it will be an evaluation. It will be a recommendation through the budget committee, a small budget committee of which Representative Porter and Senator Meltner are members of. And we'll have a review process and kind of a yes or no say on that.
Does that make sense to you, Greg Porter? I mean, both in terms of what he wants to spend the money on and how it should be divvied up?
Well,
who controls how it's divvied up?
That's the point.
Yeah,
who controls the money? I mean, when you're on the budget committee, and we vote, but you know, they're always going to win. You know, in regards to the budget committee, because it's they're people for the most part, with a couple of players, a couple of alternate players. I think with the $3 billion that's coming into the state. You're right. I just hope that we don't continue to bank it and continue to build a surplus that we have. I think it should go, yes, toward water and infrastructure like that, but I think it also should go through capital needs in regards to human infrastructure for individuals, infrastructure of capital of individuals within our community.
Focus primarily on COVID or you mentioned some of the issues were COVID-related or businesses
right.
that – were taxed, not in a fiscal sense, but burdened by this and other
right,
challenges that they might not have faced.
Exactly, because we try to do two or three pieces of amendments to take care of small businesses, not corporations, but small businesses. We also try to look at individuals and minorities, health disparities, and issues like that. We need to take care of the human infrastructure with those dollars also. Yes, they're only one-time dollars, but I've seen us take those one-time dollars and they kind of stretch out. And, you know, with us being a quote-unquote AAA, you know, bonding community and all the people coming in and et cetera, we should do more for people.
Eric Bassler, the House budget as it showed up on your doorstep did have funding for, there was funding for students who were perhaps had fallen behind, needed remediation because of the pandemic. Money for, there was a grant program for small businesses. So there were these, added up, it's probably between $200 and $300 million, I would guess. If with this federal money, is it just a matter of swapping out the federal money for those state dollars to free them up? Or is this a situation where now you have latitude to do more in that area of relief?
I think there's a few things going on, especially when it comes to education and learning loss. I think it would be a good idea to use federal dollars when possible to try to address those issues and then back those up if we still need it with some state dollars. Otherwise, we can use those state dollars on other priorities that the state would have. One thing we do need to be careful of when we look at these COVID relief dollars is as Representative Porter pointed out, they're one-time dollars, so it's not like we could build in ongoing costs related to these funds that are available. I think infrastructure makes a good sense. When I was on the city council down in Washington, we talked about sewer issues and waterworks issues, and there's a lot of buried pipe throughout the state of Indiana that is 75 years old, 50 years old, 100 years old. There could be some opportunities to do some things there over the next few years with those dollars, which would be helpful to communities really throughout the state of Indiana.
And Eddie Melton, your thoughts on this too. Do you think there's going to be a fight over how to spend these dollars, or is there going to be this kind of gentlemen's and ladies' agreement about how the money is spent and who gets to say, hey, here's where we're gonna do with it?
Right. Well, look, let me agree with everyone thus far that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. These dollars can be transformational for communities and for the state of Indiana. When we look at investing both in human capital and capital improvements from an infrastructure perspective, let's take the human capital perspective. We can look at really revamping and innovating our workforce development in K-12. Knowing that these dollars are not sustainable and these are one time, we can close that learning gap for a lot of communities that are struggling. We can get more competitive individuals prepared for the workforce that's looking to grow the state of Indiana. We know we have an opportunity where we've already made some great investments through infrastructure in 2017, but this is a unique time and opportunity with the federal dollars. And I think we should approach our budget knowing we have these funds coming down a pipeline, but still knowing our obligation as a state to craft a budget that's going to address the needs of Hoosiers.
So the 130, 150, when you start talking about millions, you know, Everett Dirksen said a million here, a million there. You would spend, there's that much now set aside, at least in the House budget, for remediation for students. Would, is that just a starting point, am I hearing you say, that you want to go a lot further than that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think when we look at our demand for workforce development as well, and I have to highlight that because as we're talking about attracting businesses, continuing to attract businesses, we're going to have a ready workforce in every part of the state. And as getting folks up to speed from an innovative perspective, and I think Indiana can do a much better job in terms of getting folks work ready. But the K-12 issue, there were already issues before COVID-19.
And of course, the budget already has the regional grants too.
And Senator Miller hit on it: $150 million, $160 million. That's fine for learning loss. However, let us not forget that there was already a gap in regards to students, minority students, and poor students in throughout the state of Indiana. So what this is, it's kind of a catch up and help give a boost for those students that had that learning loss over the last year. But we also had that, we had to make up some of that loss that was there prior to that also. Because if you remember 10 years ago, we talked about in education, you know, the addressing that gap and moving it up and things like that. So it's very important that we not forget what we didn't have so we could bring everybody into a line.
I would say, though, you know, there's a difference in this year in the pandemic and the learning loss there. It's very real. You talk to every educator and kids are falling behind. But I think that the learning gains that we've had, we were ranked in the bottom third of the nation in national academic achievement scores, and now we're in the top 10. So this is where parents have gotten involved in their kids and helped them achieve a great increase in academic achievement over the last decade.
How much of some would argue and have argued that part of the way to get, in addition to having good testing and good test prep, is teachers who know how to prepare students. And of course, we've all talked at length about the teacher shortage or the prospect of a looming teacher shortage and what many would argue is underpayment on average of the state's teachers, and yet this budget doesn't really address that, despite a gubernatorial panel that spent, 18 months looking at this issue. Why not, with all this extra money, throw dollars? And I know that you don't directly pay teachers. We'll stipulate that. But there are ways you could kind of put that pot of money out there and apply public pressure. Why not do that with all the extra?
Well, there's over $380 million that go to K-12 education over the next 2 years. And it's a local decision. I mean, you talk to local teachers and I ask them to a person, have you gone to the school board meeting? Well, no, why should we? Because it's the school board that determines what your pay is and ask them to raise your base salary and get it higher going up.
Some states, it's done at the state level, but
yes,
clearly not.
Yeah, but yeah. Here it's done at the local level. And I think your point is well taken. Teaching is going to change. I mean, the hybrid classes that we have now that are computer and in-person based are going to be the future. Parents are going to want a hybrid offered to their children going forward. There's going to be an increased demand for this different kind of learning. So what's it going to be like to be a teacher going forward?
Eric Bassler, you knew I was coming to you because you all, in addition to the title I gave you at the beginning in the introduction, you're also the chairman, of course, of the subcommittee that deals specifically with school funding within the Appropriations Committee. $380 million, roughly, again, give or take, in K-12 dollars. That's what's in the House plan that came to you. But a third of that, and I guess this is where the controversy probably arises, would be designated not for traditional public schools, but for a new assistance program, scholarship assistance program for students, a school choice program, including parochial school vouchers and so forth, that would allow a family of four earning, I think, up to, what, about $170,000 a year to qualify for this, quote-unquote, assistance. Is that the way to spend these dollars?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here, and we could spend the entire program just talking about K-12 education, K-12 funding. One thing that I'll say is last week we had a meeting, K-12 subcommittee had a meeting, and we ended up having, as a matter of fact, Senator Milton was on the committee also, and I think maybe we had somewhere around 60 people that came in and testified. And we had people from all different types of educational situations. We had everything from homeschoolers that testified, people that send their kids to charter schools, to private schools, traditional public schools, virtual schools. And I guess a couple takeaways that I had was, I guess two main takeaways. One was that all of the different types of education programs we have in the state of Indiana are really doing great things for young people and really helping our children out. Another takeaway was we still have work to do. We still send too many kids to either a two-year college or a four-year college that need remediation. So there's still work to be done. We've made great progress, as Representative Brown talked about, but we still need to continue to push it forward. And then the other takeaway was, and we're digging in and trying to take a real serious look at this, and it has to do with the area of complexity. I won't bore you with the minutiae of that.
This has to do with maybe students as English as a second language or learning disabilities. It's the factor that's supposed to address funding for those.
Yes, and people that are low to moderate income, things along those lines. And so it came through, and again, when I talk to educators, it tends to be more expensive to educate children that are in the foster care system, that are on TANF and SNAP. And then there's also additional costs related to English language learners, special education. And so we're trying to take a deep dive on that. We've spent about a year and a half looking at how we measure complexity, and I won't bore you with the minutiae of that, but how we measure it. And although it's not perfect, we were not able to find something that was better. We're going to continue to look at that and see if there's something else we can do, not for this budget, but for 2 years from now. We'll continue to use the same complexity measure that we've used in the past for this budget, but we're starting to really need to dig into that longer term to see if there's a better way to measure that.
You've sure. mentioned all these people that came in with strong feelings yep. that testified. Where's your head right now? Are you liking that where a third is going to this use? Or well, just real quickly, because I want others to weigh yeah. in, but or do you think that that's too much?
I'm agnostic as to where those dollars go. I think it's up to the parents and the families to make those decisions on how best to educate their children. Again, we had some great stories from all the different types of education that's available in Indiana, the good things that are happening, great things with young people. So I'm a big proponent of let's let families decide what is best for their children, what is best for their family situation, and then that's where the dollars end up. So if people have a beef with where those dollars end up, then they don't have a beef with me. They've got a beef with the families and the parents.
It's almost as cryptic as the governor's comment in the State of the State address where he basically said, I like public schools and I wouldn't hurt them, but we don't want to have people suffer because of the zip codes in which they live. You were want to weigh in here, Greg.
Well, I want to weigh in with Senator here. It's about $170 million that's going through that other
one third,
right?
More,
right, about $170 million, yeah. Yes, sir. But I think one thing that Senator Bastrick really hit on was looking at TANF and SNAP, which those numbers for those students are decreasing. And so I think the complexity index is very important to give those students more assistance, and maybe we may want to revisit free and reduced lunch as part of that equation. But because I believe the SNAP dollars and TANF dollars and foster care components are decreasing. So,
is this Senator? What do you make of this? I mean, this is. We were talking before the show about how so many issues aren't necessarily R versus D, but correct. Rural versus urban, and large portions of the state don't have any schools that would qualify, private schools correct. That would qualify for these voucher programs. They tend to be concentrated in our most populous communities. Does that shape your take on this? Or, you represent one of the most populous areas, certainly, right. in the state.
Well, I'll start by saying I think everyone in the legislature, especially on this panel, genuinely want our children to do well, right? It's how we get there and how we fund it. I think we may have difference of opinions on that. I want to touch a little bit on the beginning part of that question that you asked earlier about from the teacher perspective. I think adding additional new dollars so it can get more to the base for school corporations to free up funds so they can pay teachers more, I think is an opportunity as well. Because we know that one of the things that I took away from the school funding hearing, which Senator Bassner ran very well, is that equity and equality stood out in the conversation from many of our educators across the entire state, no matter it was charter or traditional public education. Equity and equality. And I think in this particular budget, we have a unique chance to kind of bring everyone up from an equal perspective. But also we have to acknowledge that everyone is not starting out at the same funding point or equity point when we look at the complexity index and the type of students that we're trying to educate. So I think it's a holistic approach and how we're going to get there. When we look at the voucher perspective, my community has we have several different options, right? Our traditional public educational school system, we're increasing in student attendance in our ADM, right, which is a great thing. But we have a lot of options for families to choose. So I'm always cautious on how we allocate resources because I know that at any given time, depending on how things shift, that families can choose one option over the other. So it's always a competitiveness within one particular community that's been a
somebody
tier.
Wins, somebody loses. Did you want to weigh in on the school issue before
we complexity touch on? Is a measurement. What's the difference between Indianapolis public school system and Zionsville? What's the difference between Crawfordsville and Fort Wayne? How do they measure differently? I mean, I would agree, teachers have come in and says, it takes us difference to teach this complex student. Okay, but if you get a second one, does it double? Because you're teaching, you're using the same method, you're using the same structure, you're using the same teacher. It hasn't doubled your cost to teach two complex students. And yet they do get double the money for two complex students. Our schools don't have the money to track the individual students. They go into their general unified operating fund. And so what it does is it just measures the difference. I guess I would say free and reduced lunch over time has been bastardized by the federal government because you get community rating. A whole school, 100% of the kids can be free and reduced lunch. Is 100% of the kids, complex kids? No. So it skews money to them when it shouldn't.
So complexity is complex. I think we can agree. Hey, I handled the truck weight formula last week's show, so I can handle any formula you throw at me. I got axles and all that stuff down. We could talk about schools. Clearly, that's more than half the budget. Another chunk that you don't really have much to do with is Medicaid. It goes up, and you need to go up with it. So we're at the margins here of what you can do. We talked about some of those things. Revenue enhancement, I'm hesitant to even bring this up because it's just such a rarity that your caucus would support, for instance, a tax increase of some sort. But it's not really for the budget. But we should probably say the cigarette tax increase. Everybody says it's not about the budget. It's about curbing a behavior that we don't want and was underscored during the pandemic just why we don't want it in terms of our health standards.
Yeah,
if that's the case, though, why isn't it going into those funds? Isn't it going into the general fund right now? And it's at 50 cents, I think, as opposed to the $2 a pack that some had suggested.
Yes, it's 50.5 to raise this to $1.50 even. It's using for general fund for Medicaid services. We've had over 200,000 people join Medicaid since the pandemic started over a year ago. And the federal government in their money given to the state says you can't necessarily look at people who have gained in income and trim the rolls or roll people off. It is against the federal law now during this pandemic to have people go off of Medicaid, so they're staying on. So we have this size of the city of Fort Wayne. Fort Wayne's to about over 200,000, but we have 200,000 more people.
But it wouldn't go to support. You wouldn't be counting on it as a fiscal crutch, because if it works according to plan, that revenue stream disappears.
Yes.
I mean, by definition.
Yes.
Does anybody, again, I'm trying to get to a lot of topics, does anybody have strong feelings about whether it should be $2, as some advocates said, or $1 or 50 cents? There are people who say 50 cents isn't even worth it.
Well, I think no matter if it's 50 cents or $2, from my perspective, House Democrats and Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, in my Indiana Minority Health Coalition, it should go toward health care, period. I mean, one thing which is in our rearview mirror, we have over $550 million in Medicaid reserve fund that we utilize to fill out the budget for 2020, okay? And so, I mean, we always have money in our Medicaid reserves, along with tuition reserves. You know, it's part of our $1.9 billion surplus that we have right now. But I think the money should go toward health care, period.
Only a couple of minutes. Anybody want to weigh in on this? I know one group, for instance, advocates for mental health recipients of services and substance abuse, they said that the budget, there's a bit of a gap there of 20-some million dollars, but I think the suggestion is that federal dollars would come in there. Should people be alarmed if they receive mental health services or substance abuse services it's not in the budget at this moment?
And that was one of my concerns when we received the House budget, was the cut of $26 million in the mental health and addiction services. With COVID and what we've seen with a rise of suicide across the nation, actually, in a rise of individuals needing those type of services, I think that's something that we should make a priority when we talk about health care. And when we look at the cigarette tax, in my opinion, I think if it's to curb a behavior, part of that is getting from a fiscal perspective and raising it to a point where folks are saying they can't afford to smoke anymore, right? I think that's going to be a part of curbing that behavior.
I have so much to talk about. I guess so people don't panic, the notion is that federal dollars would go in to fill that gap. Let me just close with this, Eric Vassler. Is there any – we think we know all the cards that are on the table when conferees, you know, those four people get together and really hammer it out in the final hours. But sometimes there's a surprise. Riverboat Gaming kind of came out of nowhere. Funding for the State Museum, which wasn't mentioned at any point. I think it was 96 was in there. Do we know everything, or can you tell us, just give us a little hint what the surprise is going to be this time, if there is one? What should we be looking for?
I guess I would be surprised if there's a surprise. I mean, we've been working on the House version of the budget since it came over to us about a month or so ago, and obviously we're going to tweak it here and there and make some changes, and I think that we're taking a serious look at the cigarette tax that we're talking about. Also, I think there's a good reason to put some tax in place with respect to vaping, whether you do that at the retail or wholesale, and there's closed systems and there's open systems. This also is complicated, like most things we deal with.
Now, I think it's at a 10% excise tax, which, again, subject to, I guess, some tweaking.
But I think what we want to do is we kind of want to use those to try to discourage behaviors that lead to a lot of health care costs, smoking and vaping and so forth. We can rely upon them in the short run as revenue, but we can't do so long run because we hope they're declining revenue source. Because
then you'll have done your job if that doesn't have any, if it has zeros in that account after a while.
Right.
That's John Schwantes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, speaking with a bipartisan legislative panel about the hammering out of the two-year state budget for Indiana. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Carrie Napoleon with the Post Tribune, Mary Frieda with the Times of Northwest Indiana, Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson, and Indiana Lawmakers host John Schwantes and his guests for being on our program today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.